We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Lee Adler. He's the publisher of Lee Adler's Liquidity Trader, The Wall Street Examiner, and CapitalStool.com. How are you today, Lee?
Good, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Excellent to have you. And thanks to Bob Coleman for, you know, the introduction to you. I'd like to kind of get your ideas on, you know, something that is a confusing topic for most of us. It's hard to kind of get a grasp on. It's going to be interesting to kind of talk all about QE, you know, treasury supply, all of these different, you know, levers that the government has to play with, the government and the Fed have to play with right now. So it does seem like there has never been a more interesting time to talk about this. Going through your writing, you've said that we're on kind of the eve of destruction. And I think we'll absolutely get into that. But why don't we start by kind of getting an idea of, let's say, the difference between M1 and M2 money supply, and to kind of clarify some of the different ideas that people have about how money just, you know, comes into existence.
Well, there's a couple kinds of money, and I'm interested primarily in central bank money, and because that's what drives stock prices. I mean, we're all about judging the direction of the stock market, identifying the current trend, and figuring out when that trend is changing direction. M1 and M2, the narrow money supply and the broad money supply, are actually irrelevant in my frame of reference, because the money gets into the market directly from the central bank into the market. Mm-hmm. So when we focus on M1, which is basically bank checking accounts and cash, that's one thing. And then M2 is a slightly broader definition of money, which includes, in addition to your checking accounts, savings accounts, and I believe retail money market funds, if I'm not mistaken, or I may be thinking about MZM. But at any rate, the broad money supply is tangential, because there is only one way that the Fed injects money into the market. There is only one way in which the Fed executes monetary policy, and that is directly via trades with primary dealers. Okay, they call that open market operations. There are two types of open market operations: temporary and permanent. And permanent operations, what they boil down to is QE, when the Fed purchases treasuries and mortgage-backed securities from primary dealers. They call that permanent open market operations, or POMO. Now, what that is, very simply, is the Fed trading with this select group of banks that they have chosen to trade with. And when the Fed does QE, when the Fed buys assets, it's not an amorphous path of money somehow filtering into the money supply and one and two, whatever. It doesn't do that at all. It goes directly into the trading accounts of the primary dealers. And they, being dealers, do what they do with that money. They trade. They may buy more treasury securities. They may buy stocks, and stocks are a very popular way for them to make money, because they have this massive marketing apparatus called CNBC and the Wall Street Journal and the entire media complex, which is their marketing arm. They may trade futures. They may trade options. But they're traders. And when the Fed buys treasuries from them, it pays them by crediting their accounts at the Fed. The central bank is the bank and the brokerage firm for the primary dealers. Mm-hmm. So when the Fed does QE, they are buying assets. They're buying bonds directly from the primary dealers. The dealers get cashed out, okay, and then they can do whatever they want with that cash. So M1 and M2 are tied to that because as the Fed pumps money into the system by buying bonds from the primary dealers, their accounts go up. They have more cash in their accounts. And then they trade. They buy securities from other counterparties. And when they buy, they pay those counterparties. And the money the Fed just created thereby goes into bank reserves, M1 and M2. So the effects of seeing M1 and M2 go up as the Fed does QE, those are secondary effects. Mm-hmm. The first effect is that the money goes into the dealer's account and they trade it. That's how it works.
So, Lee, would this be a good point to show that the chart of how QE sure. has had a direct correlation into the markets?
Absolutely. Let me just
get that up here. So here you've put together this chart showing the correlation of QE to the S&P 500, right?
Right. Yep. I actually started this chart in 2002. The Fed has been publishing this information online on the internet for over 20 years now. And I started my websites back in 2000. And I've been following the Fed since I started trading in the market in 1972. Actually, a little bit before that, I was a teenager. And the Fed didn't get much information for the first 30 years or so at that time, but over time they became more and more transparent and they decided that the best way to handle monetary policy was to tell everybody what they're going to do and then do it. And so they've been publishing this information every day for at least the last 20 years. And I began to compile it back in 2000, 2001. And that's off the left side of this chart. But that correlation, and that was way before QE. Of course, QE didn't start until 2009. Mm-hmm. But as you can see, the correlation has been fantastic since 2009. But it was also very strong, just a much lower order of magnitude prior to that, from 2002 until 2009, which was off the left side of this chart. And if we put it on a different scale, you can see that when the Fed was shrinking its balance sheet in 2007 and 2008, it caused the market to crash. And I was able to forecast that crash because I saw what the Fed was doing. They basically were cutting the primary dealers out of the process at that time in a little experiment they tried back then, mm-hmm. which was a massive failure. And then they realized in November of 2008 that all the primary dealers were going bankrupt. Lehman had already failed. Bear Stearns had failed. Merrill Lynch was failing. All of the big guys were failing. And the Fed realized that they better cut the primary dealers back into the direct process. And at that point, they started purchasing MBS, but they didn't start purchasing treasuries and MBS directly from the primary dealers until March of 2009. And that's when that line, Fed cash to primary dealers, which is akin to the Fed's total assets, that line began to rise in March of 2009. And immediately the stock market responded. And ever since then, whenever the Fed paused QE, the rise in the markets would pause. And then the Fed would again have to step on the gas and then the market would follow suit. So here we are today. The Fed is again going to try experimenting with tapering QE and trying to get down to zero QE. They'll still be doing mortgage-backed securities replacement purchases, but there's going to be, over the next couple of months, a very sharp reduction in the amount of purchases that the Fed does. So that blue line is going to turn flat again, and we know historically, when that happens, the U.S. stock market tends to have a series of accidents to the downside until the Fed reverts and goes back to its old ways of printing money. Mm-hmm.
So, Lee, who are some of these primary dealers? Would we recognize any of them by name?
Oh, sure. Well, there are, at this point, I could pull up a list, but it would take me a minute or so. It's on the New York Fed website. So let's see how many we have now. I think there were 24 the last time I counted. Of those 24, I believe 8 of them are U.S. broker-dealer subsidiaries of the big banks, but the rest of them are Canadian. Believe it or not, there's 4 Canadian banks in the list. I think 5 or 6 or 7 European banks and a few Japanese banks. But the more familiar names for you, perhaps, would be Bank of Montreal, Bank of Nova Scotia. And then on the American side, we have Bank of America Securities, of course, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan. Here we come back to another Canadian firm, RBC Capital, and TD Securities. Are you surprised by that, to know that these Canadian banks are primary dealers for the U.S. Fed?
I am a little bit, but you know, yeah. I'm trying to learn this stuff better every day for myself as well. So
there are there's typically between 20 and 24. They change from time to time. Again, there are a number of European banks, but let's count down how many are U.S. banks. There's Amherst Pierpont is one, Bank of America is 2, Cantor Fitzgerald 3, Citigroup 4, Goldman is 5, Jefferies is 6, J.P. Morgan is 7, Morgan Stanley is 8, and Wells Fargo is 9. So only nine of the 24 are U.S.-based broker-dealer subsidiaries of major multinational banks. The other 14 or 15 are worldwide banking institutions headquartered outside of the United States, but they are all broker-dealers in New York, and that's what they have in common. So these are the guys, these 24 big banks are the primary dealers who trade with the Fed and also act at the Treasury auctions to take up all of the available supply that isn't purchased directly by the public or other bidders at the Treasury auctions. Mm-hmm. That's their responsibility, by the way. That's what they get in return for being the sole party to be able to trade with the Fed. Mm-hmm.
So, Lee, were some of those other banks, like the, let's say the international banks, set up in September of 2019? And maybe this is a good spot to kind of talk about the reverse repo program.
That's a whole different issue. Mm-hmm. The reverse repos are available not just to the dealers, but they are also available to banks and money market funds. And that makes that a very different program from permanent open market operations where the Fed is buying securities solely from primary dealers. And in the old days, we used to have a regular repo operation prior to 2008. And this is how the Fed used to control the money supply, by doing daily overnight repos, which are repurchase agreements. And basically, they're just overnight loans to the banking system. So these primary dealers were the only ones who could trade either in temporary open market operations through repurchase agreements or in permanent operations through outright purchases. The Fed created the reverse repo program to ostensibly to give to soak up excess cash in the system. And it got very little use until something very important happened. The U.S. Treasury built up a cash account of about $1.8 trillion at one point at the peak of the pandemic. They were raising money hand over fist as an emergency fund, a just-in-case fund, to fund whatever programs they needed to fund. The Fed was buying all that issuance. The Treasury was selling massive amounts of paper, as you remember, from March through June of 2020 when the pandemic was raging initially. And they these debt sales, they didn't spend it all. So it ended up piling up at the Treasury. Then sometime later in February of 2021, this year, they began to worry about the debt ceiling. So they began, with all that cash that they had, the Treasury began to pay off outstanding Treasury bills. Now, who owns these Treasury bills? Money market funds, many of them government money market funds, institutional money market funds. So the Fed opens this reverse repo program to give the money market funds and others, the primary dealers and the banks, whoever, some place to put the cash that they were getting back from the Treasury. So as the Treasury began to pay off these T-bills beginning on February 23rd, 2020, they were, week after week, month after month, paying down massive amounts of T-bills. So if you're a guy who bought some T-bills, or if you're a money manager of a big money market fund, and you had bought billions in T-bills, suddenly your T-bills are getting redeemed, and you can't roll them over because the Treasury isn't issuing them anymore. So you're stuck with immense amounts of cash, and you have no way to earn anything on them, on that cash. So the Fed, in its infinite wisdom, creates this reverse repo program, and it becomes the money market fund for the money market funds. It begins to issue these reverse repos where it takes in this cash from the money market funds, and it issues a reverse repo to the fund. So now the funds, the money market funds, have an alternative. The Treasury continues paying down, and I have a chart in one of my reports, and I think you may have seen that. The Treasury continues paying down Treasury bills right up until the point that we had the first debt ceiling impasse. When was that? In October, when the first debt ceiling impasse hit. And they could not, they couldn't issue any more debt, but they wanted to keep issuing coupons. So what they did was they paid down T-bills and they kept issuing coupons. So as they paid down, as the Treasury continued to stuff money back into the money market funds, the Treasury account went down and the reverse repo account went up almost dollar for dollar. So this is a voluntary situation. The Fed was not draining reserves. It was simply providing a place for the money market funds to put their cash during this period where the debt ceiling was limiting issuance. I don't know if all that's clear. It's a complicated subject, and it helps to have the graph in front of you. But at this point, all this is changing now, because guess what? They just lifted the debt ceiling. So we now have $2.5 trillion of additional space under the debt ceiling. The federal government has raided all of its internal funds. It spent its cash down to almost zero, and now it's going to try to rebuild that cash to $600 billion. It has to repay all the internal funds that it robbed. So it's going to sell a ton of new debt here in the next couple of months. And as it does that, the reverse repo fund becomes a slush fund to fund that.
Yeah. And, you know, going through your report here, you were saying that we were going to be on the, I said it earlier here, the eve of destruction. So yeah. Let's just go back over kind of the, all of the different factors that are coming together to kind of form that environment, as you say, the eve of destruction.
The main thing is the debt ceiling being lifted. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, as the Treasury was paying down Treasury bills, mm-hmm. because the debt ceiling was limiting issuance. If you limit issuance, you limit supply, okay, and price. Bond prices are determined by supply and demand, just like everything else. So, you know, everybody was bearish on bonds, but I said, well, you know, look at these paydowns. Every month, the Treasury is stuffing $200 billion in cash into the accounts of these money market funds, the banks, primary dealers. Okay, they have to buy something with that. They're not going to put all of it into this reverse repo fund. They're using some of it to buy treasuries, which kept the price stable and the yield suppressed. And they were using a lot of it to buy stocks. So we had, you know, this ridiculous bull run, this huge bubble, this parabolic rise in stocks. But all of that has changed now because the debt ceiling has been lifted and the Treasury in the last couple of weeks has begun issuing T-bills again. Just in this week, it's I'm going to give you the exact figure if you'll bear with me here. Okay. It looks like they're going to issue, today they're issuing $65 billion in new T-bills. Now, until 2 weeks ago, they were paying down T-bills. But starting on the 21st and the 22nd, they issued $145 billion in new T-bills. Today, they're issuing another $65 billion. On the 30th, they are issuing another $15 billion. And then at the end of the month, December 31st, they have the regular coupon issuance of $150 billion. So suddenly, the U.S. Treasury is now socking the market with hundreds of billions in new issuance to try to repay all of that money that they basically robbed from Peter to pay Paul. So they're now issuing all of this new paper. The market has to absorb that. Amazingly enough, it has done it pretty well so far in the last couple of days, but there we have that reverse repo slush fund. Now, let me see if any of it got drawn down today. So the reverse repos topped out about a week ago. Yeah, we topped out at 1.758, $1.75 trillion more or less on December 20th. And in the last couple of days, that has shrunk to 1.58 trillion, and it bounced back up today a little bit. But again, in the next couple of days, we're going to have massive issuance of new paper. So this reverse repo fund is going to start shrinking. It already has. It's already come off the peak, and it will continue to shrink as the Treasury issues new paper. So it's still an immense slush fund. It's still there to cushion the market. And everything is going to look okay for a while because they're going to spend down these reverse repos, this cash that's sitting there, until they get to a point where some of these money managers are going to say, you know, I like holding Fed paper, Federal Reserve paper. I don't think I'm going to go back into T-bills or treasuries. And at some point, the reverse repo slush fund will level out. Now, I don't know where that is. Nobody knows because this is all new. But when we see that fund level out, that means the cavalry ain't coming anymore. There's not going to be this money to pull out of this big money market fund of money market funds to help support all of this massive treasury issuance. Mm-hmm. Is going to constantly be pounding the market. They're not the only ones pounding the market. Companies are issuing debt, corporate debt. Companies are issuing stock. It's not a one-way street anymore with stock buybacks. It's going in reverse because prices are so high, these guys realize that now's the time to make hay while the sun shines, to issue more paper. So we're going to see more and more paper being issued, both by the U.S. Treasury and by the private markets. What's happening at the same time? The Fed is cutting its purchases. It is reducing the amount of cash that it is injecting into the system. Now, in order to keep the bond market stable, the Fed had to buy a couple hundred billion dollars a month in paper. So they were funding almost 100% of new treasury issuance. Now they're telling us they're going to go to zero? That's not going to work. But we won't see the effects right away because, again, this slush fund, this reverse repo fund, will absorb some of that supply initially. Whether it lasts a couple of months, 2, 3, 4 months, I don't know. But we can watch it. We can track it. And the trouble will start when it either levels out or gets to zero. I don't think it'll get to zero. I think some of these guys are going to decide just to stay put with holding Federal Reserve paper.
So Lee, you just mentioned that the Fed has basically been the only one funding the Treasury market in the recent months. So what was the makeup of the Treasury market, and who was buying Treasuries before that and that aren't buying now?
Well, the Fed was only directly buying $80 billion a month in Treasuries. Okay, So the Fed was buying, and they were, the Treasury was issuing 150, 200, 250 billion back at the top of the pandemic, hundreds of billions. Of course, the Fed was printing more then too. So the Fed was directly buying 30-40% of the market of the issuance. But when the Fed buys MBS, okay, that is a cash injection to the primary dealers. So they were indirectly funding. If you add all of the QE together, both the direct Treasury purchases and the MBS purchases, they totaled between typically over the 12 years they've been doing QE, 85 to 90% of Treasury issuance. So the Fed was either buying it outright directly, or they were indirectly funding it by injecting cash into the system, enabling the primary dealers to carry out their function and others to carry out their ability to purchase and need and desire to purchase treasuries. As the Fed goes to zero from absorbing or indirectly funding 85 to 100% of the market to zero, that won't work. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Obviously they're still going to be buyers for treasuries, but not at this price level. Okay. Bond prices are going to start falling because the participants in the market who purchase this stuff are not going to pay as much. They won't have the cash available. So they're going to have to liquidate other securities in order to purchase the new supply. That means bond prices start falling. And of course, the mirror image of that is that yields rise. So there will be an increase in Treasury yields. The markets will tighten, but it won't happen right away again because of the existence of this slush fund. I think we'll start to see it in dribs and drabs in the next couple of months, but not enough to alarm anybody. I think this is going to be a more typical market top that takes many, many months to unfold in sort of a rounding top fashion. That's the way a bull market typically ends, not like it did in March of 2020.
So when all of this new supply comes into the market, Lee, could we see a real melt up as some analysts predict in the stock market?
No. not the way I look at things.
Okay.
I think in the short term, we're having a year-end effect here. I don't know, what is the market doing today? Is it going to push through this? Oh, it's coming down a little. It's actually at a key support level, the S&P 4785 is a key trend support level. If that breaks, the bears might have a foothold. On the other hand, if they get through 4807 on the ES, on the S&P futures, then we could get a little bit more of a melt-up. We've already had a melt-up off that low a week or so ago, pre-Christmas. And we've had one melt-up after another. Mm-hmm. Again, because the Treasury was paying down T-bills, and the Treasury was pumping massive amounts of cash into the market along with the Fed. That has all changed now. That's all going in reverse now. Going in the opposite direction.
So Lee, how much chaos do you think the Fed could bear before issuing another huge emergency round of QE?
Good question. Okay.
When will the markets force the Fed to reverse course?
I don't know. That's why I'm a technical analyst. That's why I trade the charts. Monetary analysis, liquidity analysis establishes context. It gives us an idea of what to expect and in some cases when to expect it, but it doesn't tell us everything. And the job of technical analysis is to identify the trend and identify the turning points in various timeframes. Mm-hmm. I've had higher targets on the S&P 500 for a long time using long-term technical indicators and technical projections that were developed many, many years ago by a guy by the name of J.M. Hirst. And, they had forecast higher prices still from here, but not that much higher. We're almost to the level where those projections were pointing on the long term. When's the Fed going to panic? Who knows? I don't know. I mean, normally, when you get to 20% down and you get a CNBC declared bear market, that the Wall Street Bureau of Standards of Weights and Measures, 20% is a bear market. Yeah. Who made that up? It's like everybody accepts it, but who made it up? Where did it come from? 20%. The Fed doesn't like to see a 20% decline. Now, it swung into action a little bit late in the pandemic pandemonium meltdown in March and April. Mm-hmm. And normally when the Fed starts or restarts QE or increases QE, the market responds almost instantaneously. This time that didn't happen. It took days. It took days and the market kept going down and it got very scary. But they pumped so much money, I mean, trillions in the space of a couple of weeks. The primary dealers were so loaded with cash, even though they were broke, they were flat on their backs. They were so loaded with cash, they started buying. Well, the word went out, it's time to buy. And they got it turned around. Are they going to be so lucky next time? I don't know. Or will it take longer? I don't know. Is somebody really going to fail? Is the Fed going to allow it? I do not know. The Fed's history has been a series of long-term serial blunders. And the next mistake is required by the last mistake. And each one gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But at a certain point, you reach critical mass where they can't rescue it anymore. And My gut feeling, having watched markets since the 1960s when I was a little kid and a teenager in the late 60s, my gut feeling is we're probably at the end game here. And I think that we may be facing the prospect of a secular bear market that the Fed might be willing to live with, because now we have this inflation problem, 1970s style or worse inflation that has come back. Mm-hmm. We knew it wasn't transitory because inflation follows the money supply, and Milton Friedman was correct in that regard. And we've had a tremendous amount of inflation for the last 12 years. It just wasn't in the inflation that economists count. It was inflation of assets. All right, so you inflated stocks, you inflated bonds, you inflated housing. They don't count that stuff. It's pure inflation, but they were ignoring it because consumer prices stayed low. Mm-hmm. Why did consumer prices stay low? Because there was no trickle down. The money that the Fed pumped into the market through the primary dealers stayed with these massive funds that held that money, and they used it to buy more assets. So we had asset inflation. What is the manifestation of asset inflation? Price earnings ratios. Why are price earnings ratios going from 10 or 15 times, which was normal for my entire life until the last 15 years, to 20, 30, I mean, 40 or 50 times earnings as a norm, and many more times that in bubble stocks? Mm-hmm. Why? Because the Fed deliberately inflated asset prices. So we've had massive inflation already. Now, because they created helicopter money with the pandemic programs, now we have consumer price inflation on top of all the asset price inflation. And it's going to be very, very difficult to rein that in. You know, historically, we haven't reined in inflation until Volcker literally shut down the market and made positive interest rates so punitive that it shut down the economy. So I think we're going to see interest rates rise and inflation rise in tandem as historically they have. I think we're in for a very, very rough time, both for inflation, for interest rates, and for the markets. But the topping process will take time. And there is going to be a rally that fools the majority, and there's probably going to be another rally that fools the majority, and everybody's, you know, the market's going to come down, it's going to rally back, might make a minor new high, then it won't make a minor new high, but it'll have a big rally, and this will go on for months. But eventually, it'll break down. You know, then the question becomes, what does the Fed do and when does it do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, Lee, really Powell is stuck between a rock and a hard place. He has to... What's that? Of its own making, absolutely. Yeah, because they have to...
Janet Yellen, God bless her soul, was the only Fed chair to try to shrink the balance sheet and to try to, you know, bring some order to this chaos. When Powell came in and the 10-year yield got up to 3%, they panicked. They just panicked and they said, we can't sustain this. We have to keep printing money. And this was Bernanke's intent when he started all this crap, printing money endlessly. He wanted to tie the Fed's hands and he did.
So what happens to the mythical transitory inflation once we get that crash, Lee? Do we get a deflationary crash that brings inflation back, or do we need rates to go up to be able to make that happen?
That's above my pay grade, Tom. I'm just a liquidity analyst and a technical analyst. I want to I want to determine what the direction of stock prices is. Of course, I track gold also from a technical perspective, mm-hmm. you know, and hopefully that'll pop through that 1810 area and get going. But, you know, as far as what inflation is going to do in the long run, whether it's going to turn into a deflation, I have no idea. And to me, it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter because we are technical analysts first. We are liquidity analysts first. And that's what matters. That's what drives. We want to know the price trend of our investments or our potential investments. Everything else is fluff. Everything else is diversion. It's tangential. It has nothing to do with what our purpose is as investors, which is to get the price trend right.
So, Lee, I want to take kind of a sideways step here and ask you about withholding tax collections and yes. why you watch it so closely.
Okay. Well, the government, the federal government publishes all kinds of economic indicators that are based on surveys, all right? And then they take that survey data and they statistically manipulate it from here to kingdom come until it's unrecognizable. It's several weeks or months late. They revise it the next month. They revise it the following month. They revise it every year for the next 5 years. They use a statistical adjustment measure called X13 ARIMA, which is really a moving average based thing. And it's supposed to be a 12-year moving average. Except the funny thing about it is they only use the last 5 years. They make up the future years and then they subsequently adjust to fit the line to what actually happened. So when we look at a chart and we're looking in the past, we're seeing something that they retroactively fit to reality. Okay, so all of these statistical methods of economic tracking obscure what's really going on with the U.S. economy. The withholding tax data is published by the U.S. Treasury every single day. It's not manipulated. It's raw data. It's real. It tells us what the economy is doing right now, right here in real time. So I've been tracking that for the last 20 years. I have a beautiful chart of that. The Treasury in the last few months actually started publishing that data that you can chart it yourself. You didn't used to be able to do that. I did. I kept that data on my own. But now you can do it yourself. So you can track withholding. You can draw a chart. You can see the trend. And the U.S. economy is not budging from this very rapid expansion pace. You know, they every month, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, the Washington Post, Yahoo Finance, they all have to have said Market Watch. They all have to have something to talk about. So these economic reports come out and they make a big deal out of everything and they get everybody all excited. It's meaningless. We know what direction the markets or the economy is going in. And why is it important? Because the economy itself isn't that important. Withholding taxes are the thing we want to know because that's the revenue stream. And the revenue stream is what determines how much debt the Treasury has to issue. The other part of that is their spending. And we have a question mark on the spending now because we don't know what they're going to do with the this recovery, the Build Better Back program or whatever. Mm-hmm. We're going to spend a couple trillion. But maybe even that's not relevant. What's 2 trillion over 10 years? Mm-hmm. You know, it's 15, 18 billion a month. That's nothing in today's context. So whether they do Build Back Better or not, I don't care. But I do want to know how strong that revenue is, because if the economy somehow manages to keep just blowing the roof off the way it has been, there's going to be more revenue. And that's going to shrink the amount of treasury supply that's hitting the market. And that might make the situation a little bit easier, but not easy enough to accommodate zero QE. That's never going to happen. If the Fed's at zero, the market will not be able to absorb it, and rates will rise, yields will rise. And the economy probably won't be able to survive that at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, muddle through is always possible. They've managed to do it time and time again. These are very, very smart guys. They make a lot of mistakes, but they usually figure out, you know, like Houdini, how to get out of a trap that looks like they can't get out. So mm-hmm. we'll just have to see. That's why I do the charts. I want to identify the trend and not be surprised by whatever the Fed does or doesn't do. Let's see where the trend is headed. Mm-hmm.
So Lee, where do you protect or grow your capital in this environment? Are you continuing to be long stocks and won't go short until the signs present themselves? And how does gold hold up in this scenario?
Gold is in a very tenuous spot, but it's at a fulcrum. It's certainly at a point at which it's do or die. And if it does, if it can pop through resistance here on the upside, it's going to be a very good place to be. And the mining stocks will be a terrific place to be. I don't have my chart in front of me for gold right now, but there is a certain support level, which I write about it every week. I forget where it is, 1750 or something like that. If it doesn't hold, the long-term trend is going to be reasserted to the downside. And, you know, I can't explain it. I don't understand the fundamentals of why gold would be going lower in this environment. You know, my common sense would say to me, you know, this is a good time to buy. But I'd rather be a little bit late than to misjudge what this trend is, because when gold goes down, it goes down fast. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a possibility. Where do you keep your assets safe? Where would I keep my assets safe? Right now, it's boring, but I can't tell other people what to do. But to me, cash is the place to be. Now, there are, as a digital nomad, you know, I know things about the worldwide real estate market. It's very overpriced right now, but the short-term rental market still generates very positive returns. I don't like the idea of having a lot of leverage there, because then you get your property taken away from you and you lose everything. But, you know, I like buying short-term Airbnb-type rental properties, and I'm going to be doing that in the very near future. I'm cashing out of my property in Florida. And I don't like a lot of leverage here, because, again, I think it's going to be working against us. Cash is dull, and it's going to be eaten away by inflation. But it'll probably be worse to own bonds. Stocks, I think we're in the end game here. If you buy them, you'd better be ready to sell them. I think we're very, very close to the top. So, you know, traders, a lot of the people that follow me are short-term traders. Fine. If they want to buy, I'm all for that. I do a daily day trading post on capitalstool.com, our message board. And, you know, we keep an eye on the short-term trading aspects of it too. So guys that trade can do very well, regardless of the environment. Mm-hmm. Selling short, I've been a little early. I made some money on the short side with some of my stock trading short picks. And gave it all back. I said, I told my readers last week, okay, I'm taking a vacation this week. And I put on some shorts last week that didn't have any stops. And they wiped out all of our profits from the last couple of weeks. So you still gotta be careful with selling short. But the time is coming where there's gonna be money to be made on the short side of the stock market. That mm-hmm. time is coming.
Yeah. So Lee, I'd like to kind of conclude on an interesting thought. You know, reading through your work, you're kind of commenting on the quality and source of information. So where do you find best sources of news or information, and how do you vet them to be able to find a source that you trust?
News is noise. I kind of learned that from Joe Granville many years ago. You know, it's interesting. It's fun to watch and, you know, see the misses, you know, the economic misses and the economic beats and all that stuff. But it's really irrelevant. So, you know, what news source you use, take it all with a grain of salt, because the market is going to go in the direction that the Fed wants it to go in. There are basically only two rules that you need to know. And one of them isn't follow the news. Okay. One of them is don't fight the Fed. That's rule number one. Rule number two is the trend is your friend, or otherwise known as don't fight the tape. Okay. It's not don't fight the news. The news is your friend. The news is a joke. It's a waste of time. We want to know whether the economy is generating revenue. We want to know whether that revenue is going to cause a reduction in supply enough to offset the Fed's reduction in QE. It will not. So, you know, the data to follow is data that's published by the federal government, the daily Treasury statement, Of course, the Fed publishes the weekly H41 report, which is the Fed's balance sheet every week. They publish the weekly banking system report, the H8. There is a plethora of data out there, primary data that you can follow, that I analyze and I chart it and I track it and I try my best to make it understandable and relevant to the people that subscribe to my services. And hopefully they can gain some perspective on how to trade the markets from what I do. But as far as watching CNBC, I mean, come on, don't waste your time. Reading the Wall Street Journal, don't waste your time. I haven't watched CNBC in 20 years. I haven't read the Wall Street Journal in 15 years. It's garbage. I mean, there's a couple guys there that are good, that do good analytical work, but they're not really trying to discern what's going to happen next. You know, they're trying to tell people, oh, here's what's happening now. And they get it. Sometimes they get it half right, but normally they don't really understand what they're talking about. There's just a couple guys. There's a couple guys at the Wall Street Journal that I like. And at CNBC, I really don't know. So I don't know. I don't know what sources to tell people. I would tell them to ignore all of it and just trade the charts, you know, watch the trend. That's it. Mm-hmm.
Perfectly. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Do you have anything you'd like to share with our audience before we do?
Well, I would invite them to come and visit wallstreetexaminer.com, where they can follow some of my free thoughts. And if they're interested in my proprietary research, to by all means visit me at liquiditytrader.com, and they can try any of my services for 90 days risk-free. And if they don't like it, just let me know and I'll send their money back. But I certainly would like to have some of your subscribers join me.
Absolutely. You do put a lot of great work into that. We can follow you on Twitter as well, @Lee_Adler.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I post some thoughts up there and do a little trash talking on Twitter. And during the day, if you're interested in very short-term trading, you can track me on capitalschool.com. And I would love it if more people would join the conversation. We'd like to have a little bit of fun there with the market.
Sounds great, Lee. Well, I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.